Welcome to the Get Ready Podcast. Today we are on episode 5 of our 10-part series, How to Get Prepared for a 3-Month SHTF Event. First up is the Mindset Minute. Then we start off the main topic with an apocalyptic scenario that will get you thinking about how your home will function without power. We'll do a product spotlight and an Are You Ready for WROL question. If your prepping tank is running on empty, this episode is for you. Here are your hosts, RB and JD.
Thank you, Jeffries. Welcome to the Get Ready Podcast. This is RB, joined by my friend and co-host, JD.
Hello, everyone. Today, we're talking all about power. How do we heat, cook, charge devices, and drive vehicles when the grid is down and the gas stations are empty?
This is the Mindset Minute.
Today's Mindset Minute is going to be a little bit different because we're going to talk about technology, specifically AI. Why, you ask? Because how you prep is in large part based on what you're prepping for. And there's been some big developments in AI lately that totally changed the game. Here's the problem with AI.
Terminators.
The biggest issue is the sheer magnitude of difference in intelligence between humans and computers. It's not like AI is 10 times smarter than humans. In a few years, AI will be billions of times smarter than humans. I know that sounds crazy, but think about it like this. Like 20 years ago, humans were teaching computers how to play chess. Today, it's the computers training grandmasters on how to perfect their chess game. Think about that for a second. Take the best chess grandmaster who ever lived and have them play 1 million games against the best chess computer. Most of those games will be a draw. Some of them will be won by the computer. None of them will be won by humans. Now imagine this in a military setting. America has an insane defense budget, and they're investing heavily in AI. So soon, all of our tanks, planes, subs, and drones are going to be AI assisted. What do you think Russia's going to do against an AI-led U.S. military when they're struggling to launch a conventional war against Ukraine? Basically, they have no chance, and they know this. Like, unless they do one thing, and that is hit at AI's Achilles heel, which is an EMP. An EMP knocks out all electronic devices. What makes an EMP? Nukes. Who has got a lot of nukes? Russia. Are the pieces coming together? The pieces came together for me when I read a report last week on how China is developing advanced EMP weapons to counter the US's AI superiority. So here's how I think it'll play out. I think Russia sees the writing on the wall. They're not just going to lob nukes at the US because we've got plenty of nukes pointing back at them. I think they take the sneaky way, which is to do a partnership between Russia, China, and Iran. You take a shipping container and you put a nuclear-tipped missile in the shipping container and then send that shipping container around the world through Chinese seaports. And that container ship is manned by Iranian terrorists. And then you launch the missile, the EMP, and blow up the ship so there's no evidence. And I think if you're really good, you try to time it so that there's a massive weather event happening in the US, maybe around winter, maybe it's a hurricane. So we're already having a big chunk of the US, the power is out. The EMP hits, and then you immediately follow it up with cyber attacks, taking down the system. So you have three fronts happening simultaneously. Now, here's the mindset part. The more advanced AI becomes, the more likely we are to get hit by an EMP. So you don't just prepare for a natural disaster or a financial collapse. You've got to prepare for the worst case scenario. You've got to wrap your mind around the unthinkable, because thanks to AI, what seems unthinkable today may just become the reality of tomorrow.
The main topic.
Jeffries asked us if he could read some of his prepper fiction on air. So, of course, we said, absolutely. This short story is going to create a little environment for us to discuss the topics of fuel and energy for your home in an SHTF situation. So with that, Jeffries, it's all yours, buddy.
Friday evening. You and your wife are pressed between a packed crowd on the school's bleachers, eyes glued to your son's soccer game. A distant rumble echoes, chilling the air. The field lights vanish, but the setting sun lends an eerie glow. The ref orders, "Keep playing." Your wife nudges you, voice tinged with unease. "My phone's dead." You check yours. Your face stares back at you from the dark, mirror-like screen. "Let's go," you decide, making your way toward your son. You call his name, his eyes lock onto yours, and he asks, "What's wrong?" "Time to leave," you murmur. Coach Jensen protests, "We've got 20 minutes. You apologize, "Sorry, coach. We've got to leave." In the parking lot, you pull the handle of your wife's 2015 van and climb into the driver's seat. The unlit dome light signals the van's lack of life. You press the ignition anyway, the silence mocks you. Your son inquires, "What's happening?" Two spots away, a truck roars to life. You leap from your van, spotting Carl from your church. "Carl," you wave frantically, rushing over. "My car's dead. Can you give us a lift?" Carl hesitates, then nods, signaling you to get in. Your wife and son squeeze into the back, and you take the front seat. As the park fades behind you, you and Carl speculate. He throws out the notion of an EMP, and you find yourself nodding in agreement. He delves into potential attackers, but your thoughts dwell elsewhere. In your neighborhood, darkness reigns, no streetlights, no porch lamps, no interior glimmers. It's an unsettling sight, given the fading twilight. You thank Carl as he pulls away, and uncertainty creeps in. October chills the air, a whisper of the low 50s. You reach for your phone to check the weather app, only to be reminded it's a lifeless brick. Inside, your wife fetches the blackout box of lights, while you brave the garage, hoping the generator still works. After countless futile yanks on the pull cord, it remains silent. The light from a headlamp spills into the kitchen. Your wife opens the back door, her voice carrying over, "The stove's off, but we've got some frozen burgers for the grill." Your response is a nonchalant "Sounds good." You snatch a flashlight from the table and descend into the basement to retrieve your firearms. The safe's keypad offers no response, leaving you with a gnawing sense of unease. Above, your wife hears thumping from below and calls out, "Everything okay?" You muster a feeble, "Yeah." She then asks if you could change the propane can for the grill, but you don't respond, remembering this was the weekend you intended to refill the empty propane tanks. Your wife insists, "Honey?" At this point, you remain silent, seated in front of the locked safe, pondering what horrors the night might unveil.
Wow, you didn't expect us to hit you with that tasty prepper fiction right there, did you? Now, imagine if that really was you. Like, it's terrifying to think that you might not be able to provide basic heating and cooking for your family. And the worst part is, you know the lights aren't coming back on. You know that an EMP is possible. Yet the normalcy bias is super tough to overcome. We realize that. But overcoming normalcy bias is exactly what we're trying to do with this podcast. So JD and I are going to go through different fuel types and help you put together a game plan for your energy needs. Let's start out by listing out all the different energy types, and then we'll go through each one of those and we'll give them a rating for a 3-month emergency. So JD, what comes to mind?
Homes generally use a mix of natural gas, propane, or electricity. You've got gas and diesel for engines and renewables like wood, solar, hydro, or wind for heating and cooking.
Okay, so you mentioned natural gas. Let's start with natural gas. I didn't realize this, but 61% of homes in the United States use natural gas. I've never used it before. It's never been in a house I've lived in. But the idea is pretty cool. It's a utility company, has a pipe into your house. You run your cooking, your heating, and your hot water heater basically off the natural gas. But I will say one pretty cool thing about natural gas that's different than electricity is that if a storm knocks out your power, the gas continues to flow because these natural gas companies have backup systems. But what happens to those backup systems if the company's hit by an EMP? JD?
So these natural gas companies have thought through grid down situations. Their power stations run off grid electricity, but they have backup generators that are fueled by natural gas, which allows them to keep operating in a grid down event. If an EMP affects their generators, then no, natural gas won't be flowing. But in the case of a cyber attack or a big storm or, you know, other types of grid down scenarios that you could think of, so long as the generators still function, you will still get natural gas to your home for a while anyway.
Okay, so EMP, natural gas is kind of out. But what if you take one of those scenarios where it's just a cyber attack or just a natural disaster, you still got natural gas flowing into your pipes. What sort of appliances are going to work in that scenario?
So newer gas stoves have what's called an interlock, which shuts off gas to the stove unless it has electricity. Your stove's manual will tell you if it has one. The older gas stoves will still work. You just light a match, that'll act as the pilot light, and you can get the stovetop to work. But not the oven. The pilot light for the oven is much harder to get to. You most likely won't be able to get that going.
What about like a natural gas fireplace?
Same thing, just like the stovetop. Newer models, if there's no electricity running to them, you might be in some trouble. But with the older models, you should be able to use your match as your pilot light to get it started.
All right, what other appliances would work without electricity if you had the gas flowing?
I mean, that's pretty much it. Your furnace is going to require electricity to power the fans that blow hot air around your house. Your water tank or tankless gas water heaters are probably not going to work. Most people don't realize this, but you can get refrigerators and chest freezers that work off of natural gas, which would be pretty cool if you were able to keep that steak cold during an SHTF event. You can also get a natural gas generator that will generate electricity. Something like that could get your devices up and running if an EMP didn't knock them out. In my development, there are companies like Generac that build these whole house generators that run off of natural gas. And as soon as the power goes out, these generators click on. And that could be a good solution so long as an EMP doesn't knock them out.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is in a case of an EMP, you're pretty much out of luck completely. If it's not an EMP, there's a couple devices that would work, basically your stovetop and fireplace. That's pretty much it. Given that, what do you rate natural gas as an energy source for a 3-month SHTF event?
So I give natural gas about a 3. The pros are that it will continue to flow even in a grid down event, but the cons are that it's very limited use cases as to what you can use it for, and it's not something that you can go out and produce yourself.
Yeah, I also think like a 2 or 3, you're grid tied. In essence, the natural gas is the grid that you're connected to. So in an EMP, you're out of luck. This is why the mindset minute is so important. I, for one, have really started to be more and more concerned about an EMP hitting. And therefore, when I'm looking at what are my energy sources, I just assume that it's going to be an EMP that knocks it out. So natural gas, super low for me. All right, propane.
So propane is natural gas's sassy, independent, older sister. Everything works the same as natural gas, except propane lives in our own little bunker buried in your backyard. Unlike the natural gas companies, your propane tank won't be affected in an EMP. It'll continue to flow into your home in just about any emergency. It all comes down to how much propane have you stored.
Yeah. The thing I like about propane is it doesn't go bad. It can be stored indefinitely. The tanks do have some limitations. So underground tanks, they've last 20 to 30 years before they start to corrode and then leak. Above ground tanks, they can freeze, water can get in. Actually, when we lived in an RV, we had 2 30-pound propane tanks at the front of the RV, and they came with a little plastic cover. We never had any problems with leaking or water getting in. I would say if you've got propane tanks outside, just go ahead and put a cover on them to help keep moisture out. All right, so propane, all of the benefits of natural gas without the downsides. So an EMP exists, it's still gonna be able to flow into your house. Let's talk about the tank itself. Above ground tank or underground tank, what's better?
Below ground tanks are more expensive, but they're better for a few reasons. Number one, nobody knows that you have propane, and that decreases theft and threats from your neighbors. They can't be shot at, and they don't take up space you could use for a garden or whatever else it is you wanted to do with that space.
Yeah, strong arguments. What else about propane haven't we mentioned yet?
So it comes in canisters, and that makes it really convenient for things like grills and small heaters. So cooking food and staying warm. You get these mini 1-pound Coleman propane fuel tanks that you can use for Mr. Buddy heaters. And the idea is that you would buy a 20-pound propane gas tank and get an adapter for like $10. And then you could continue to fill those 1 pound Coleman propane tanks from that 20 pound larger tank. So that way you have propane stored up and a method to distribute it to appliances that you can actually put in your house.
Yeah, we did that exactly when we were in the RV. If anyone is planning on bugging out an RV, talk to me first because I will give you some insights here. But when we were in an RV, obviously we didn't have a wood stove in the RV, so we used propane. One thing we realized in the winter that we didn't expect is a hot RV inside and a cold temperature outside created a lot of condensation on the windows. And eventually that condensation would add a lot of humidity to the air. We started having mold issues. The interior walls of the RV started to be affected by the moisture. It was just a very tough situation. So you need to have, if you're in a tent or an RV, you need to have a way of insulating the inside so there's not that huge temperature difference. You don't have to deal with moisture. Another consideration if you're in a small confined space and you're using propane to heat is you should really have a carbon monoxide detector. Like that's one of those small devices that we'll talk about later on, when it's how do you charge these small devices? How do we recharge batteries? Things like a carbon monoxide detector could be a really big deal. You don't want to go to sleep and never wake up. All this time, you're telling your friends, hey, you need to prepare. It finally happens. It'd be pretty lame after telling them all these years how right you are, only for you to be killed by propane.
Embarrassing. So what are your final thoughts on propane?
Yeah, if you just want to live off-grid and you aren't even thinking about an EMP, you just love the off-grid life, propane is a must. It's like the foundational fuel for off-grid living. You definitely need to have propane. And even in an EMP, your propane's still going to work great. There's just a couple considerations. Like take, for example, the Amish. They live off-grid. They use solar. They use air compressors. They use propane and natural gas if it's available. But all of their refrigerators, freezers, generators, all of that stuff can run off natural gas or propane. So those are key fuels for off-grid living, especially in an EMP scenario. How do you rate propane out of a 1 to 10 rating for a 3-month emergency?
I give propane a 7. I mean, you're only limited by how much you can store. And by getting some of these large tanks, you could keep them in your backyard for forever, really, so long as you protect them from the elements and then you've always got them on hand. I love propane as a fuel type to keep you warm and fed during a 3-month SHTF event.
I like propane too much. To me, it's an 8, 8.5. I kind of have a bit biased because it was so important when we were living off-grid that I couldn't actually imagine off-grid living without propane. So I would give it a 10 other than the fact that you can't create your own propane. It's not renewable. So you have what you have when the lights go out and that's it. All right, so let's take a quick break. Read a card from Southern Prepper Ones. Are you ready for Raw Card Game?
On April 30th, 2030, in the midst of the new Great Depression in Akron, Ohio, a bank run has left your family with no access to their savings. Your father has lost his job, and your family is now struggling to put food on the table. A friend tells you that the next day dozens and maybe even hundreds of people will meet at the bank's main branch and storm it to try and grab any cash they can. Would you tip off the authorities, or maybe join the crowds of people and have a chance of putting food on your table, or would you just not get involved?
So, I think what you're asking me is, would I break the law to feed my family? If that's the question, then obviously yes. Would I tip off law enforcement if I knew something illegal was going down in a WROL situation? No, I probably wouldn't. I just don't know if this is the scenario, like if this is the hill I'm gonna die on in this situation. You know, run on the bank, everyone's gonna be running at the bank. If I know about it, I can guarantee you the authorities know about it. And I don't really know if this is my style, my MO to put food on the table in this event. I might look for another opportunity. What about you?
Yeah, I agree with you. I guess it depends on how desperate we are. And if that's our only option for food, I think what I might do is maybe show up to the event on the outskirts and just watch and see how many police show up, if people are getting arrested, if people are successful. I don't think I have the moral issue of taking my money out of the bank. It's more of the risk of getting arrested or something getting damaged, people robbing me after, that sort of thing I'd be more concerned about. So I'd probably kind of hedge my bet, watch from a distance. If things are going successfully, try to jump in the fray, get what I could. Very mob mentality. Almost like sheep, right? You, as a sheep, you don't want to be the one that's picked off. You kind of watch if the herd is moving. You move with the herd. There's safety in numbers. But if the cops are there and it looks like, hey, there's going to be some real fisticuffs, I'll probably back off and live to see another day.
Yep. All right, great. Let's talk about renewables. We've got to talk about them. You know, I think this is what most preppers are curious about. There is a bit of a debate. If you go online and you read some of the forums and you get involved, you'll see that there is disagreement between solar, wind, and hydro as to being the primary source of power. But out of those three, in your opinion, which is the best choice for preppers?
I can't speak to wind. I've never done anything with wind. I have done solar in the RV and in my last house. But from what I've read, what I've researched, solar is the clear winner. I don't even think it's a debate when it comes to the practicality. Solar has it hands down. Wind and hydro are super specific to the environments that work well. So take wind power, for example, right? Wind needs very consistent wind blowing through. In Virginia, at least, we do not have consistent winds. We've got huge gushes of wind when thunderstorms come through. Other than that, it's pretty still. But maybe out in the plains, where you've got these big wind farms, you can stick a turbine super high up in the air. Maybe it makes sense. It's also, from what I understand, wind turbines are super loud. So if you're in a suburban block and your house has a giant wind turbine on top of it, A, everyone's going to know that something weird is going on there. And B, it's going to be making massive amounts of noise. So wind is a no-go for me. Hydro basically requires a waterfall to work or a large enough elevation drop. Here's the calculation for water. So it's elevation drop times volume divided by 10. So for example, if you had a 25-foot drop where the water drops 25 foot and you have 25 gallons of flow, you multiply 25 times 25, you get 625. Divided by 10, you get 62.5 watts. What are you going to run off of 62.5 watts? That's like barely a light bulb. A chest freezer, for frame of reference, takes 600 watts to power up. You need a system 10 times larger than what I described. So that means a 250-foot drop. Imagine a waterfall 250 feet or flow of 250 gallons a minute, which is massive. There's no creeks or streams that's got that sort of setup, or very few, especially where I live. So it's not super practical for most preppers. Now, if you needed those 600 watts to power that freezer, you could just use three 200 watt solar panels. So the efficiency between the two is night and day. Most solar systems, they also have inputs for hydro and wind. So as long as you got the right setup with solar as your primary, you can still add wind or hydro depending on your conditions, but make sure you've got solar powering most of what you need.
So how about powering your entire house using solar? Is that a good idea, or you don't think that's practical?
You can absolutely power your entire house. I actually think the systems these days are getting better. In some ways, they're more expensive. In other ways, costs are coming down. So costs are coming down, but the technology is improving at such a rate that if you want the best technology, then you're still going to pay a lot of money. So the first benefit is if you have a solar system, your electricity bill drops to hopefully zero, in which case you can take that money, put it towards other preps, which is great. Your energy production is going to change throughout the year. So in the summer, you're going to have super high production. In the winter, it's generally going to be less. So you've really got to spec your house properly to make that work. The other consideration is many times these solar systems are not battery tied. They're only grid tied. So a lot of people are buying these solar systems thinking, oh, I'm in the solar. And then the grid goes down and you can't run anything in your house because you don't have batteries, and batteries are expensive. A lot of installers don't like installing the battery system. So you really, if you're going to do whole house, you've got to do a battery system. And there are EMP hardened batteries out. I know Solark produces an EMP hardened battery. So there are things you can do to protect against EMP. The problem is you got all your eggs in one basket. So definitely pros and cons to a whole house solar system. Let's walk through some of the pros and cons. I think this is something folks are really interested in. What are some pros you can think of for a whole house solar system?
Yeah, well, number one, you're going to lower your electricity bill and you're going to generate your own power off of the grid. There's some good financial incentives as well. 30% federal tax rebate. Who said the federal government wasn't good for anything? Plus potential state credits. You got parts and installation that are readily available. The installation can happen both in the suburbs as well as in rural homes. And it will allow for more devices because more and more devices are moving to electric. So cars, power tools, small devices. And so having a renewable source of electricity that's powering your home will allow you to charge those devices.
Yeah. I like the fact that the power company isn't controlling how much you pay for electricity. Because if they just want to jack up your electricity rates, nothing you could really do about it. If you're on solar, you have some independence. The other thing I like is there's a cultural shift towards solar. And I think a lot of this is from like the Democrats and liberals, in which there's now an environmental friendly perception. So you can put solar panels on your house, in your yard, and you're not considered the crazy prepper. You're considered an environmentally friendly, you're an ally of the climate emergency.
Joe Biden.
All right, how about the cons of having a solar system set up?
All right, well, if it was easy, we'd all have it, right? Mm-hmm. So they're expensive. In order to get that complete replacement for your electric bill, there's a lot of setup. It is expensive. The panels are going to tell the world that you might have some electricity if the grid were to go down. And these panels can be destroyed. The system is vulnerable to an EMP. Yes, you do get EMP hardened ones that cost extra, but your average run-of-the-mill, out-of-the-box solar system that you get installed is going to go down just like the rest of us in an EMP. And your power production is going to depend on weather conditions. You know, cloudy days and winter specifically means less electricity produced.
Yeah, I love solar. But even EMP aside, if something breaks in your system, like there's a lot of complex components in there, you're not going to be able to just fix it like you would fix an old car. Like you've got to get really specific components. Chances are you're not going to have a backup system that you can just pull a missing piece from and replace it. Again, all of your eggs are really in one basket. So I am a little bit concerned about that. In terms of the benefits of it, I love the fact that I can now plug in my mower into my house, charge that. And the benefit from a homesteading perspective is if you have animals, if you're planning on having livestock, they're probably going to need hay over the winter. And if you can't buy hay from other farmers, you've got to produce it yourself. Hay is just dried grass. You could cut grass by hand using a scythe, but it's much more efficient if you've got a mower with a bagger and you could drive around, mow it all up, lay it out in a row, let it dry, and then rake it into a haystack. And there is some debate as whether grass that's cut up in short strands versus having a whole long piece of grass is less nutrition. There's also a little bit of concern from noise discipline if you've got a mower going. Even though electric mowers are quiet, they're not totally silent. So if someone's close to you walking by, they may still hear your electric mower or your electric chainsaw. So there are those concerns.
When you lived off-grid in the RV, you had both propane and electric. What were some of the differences between the two?
I loved both of them. I liked solar better because it was free. We could just generate it ourselves. And when the sun's shining, you could splurge. You can charge up batteries, run everything as much as you want. It's a lot of fun when you've got the solar system cutting in and you're saving a lot of money. So all of that I love. The problem with solar is that there's something solar does very inefficiently, primarily heating. So that goes for cooking and space heating. So in that case, you really want to have propane, especially in the winter when the sun is only out for a couple hours, or if there's a storm that passes through and you get a string of cloudy days, your solar is really going to struggle. So you're going to want to have wood or propane to take care of the heating and the cooking uses. The problem with propane, as you mentioned, is it's not renewable. So primarily, you're going to run as much as you can off of solar and then back into propane and then have a generator that you can run to recharge your batteries. So think of it as like layers. It's not just one or the other. It's as much as everything to give you some redundancy to your plan.
It's very similar to what we discussed with our food plan. You know, to go all in on one particular type of food is a mistake. So you want different layers to your food plan. Same thing for power.
Yeah, and even within power, take solar for example, you've got the solar system, which is generating electricity, but there's other things you can do in solar. You can buy a sun oven and you can heat your food. You can have a greenhouse and put your water tank in your greenhouse and heat that up and then take a warm shower. We do that in our greenhouse. You can dehydrate food with a solar dehydrator. So there's other ways you can use the sun that doesn't require a solar panel-based system, and do it all. Do as much as you can, use it as much as possible. That's one of the most resilient approaches you can take, is to have sun passively heat or cook.
Great. So how do you rate solar as an energy source for a 3-month emergency?
I think a whole house system, like the kind I have, like the kind most people have, is probably a 2. If you've got a battery backup. So if it's grid tied, it's a 2. If it's a battery backup, it's probably a 5. If it's an EMP hardened battery system, it's probably a 7 or an 8. Now that's for a whole house system. And I think what I'd prefer to get to like an 8 or 9, I would do smaller systems. They maybe have 1 or 2 panels. You can use them for specific appliances or specific devices. You can have multiple of them. You can easily put them in a Faraday cage. If one breaks, you still got backups. You can scavenge parts from the other to repair the ones that broke. There's a lot of benefits of having multiple small solar systems as opposed to one big one. So what did I say, 3, 5, and 8?
Yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the EMP hardened ones system is probably, it's much higher for me. It's probably like an 8 or a 9. Like I love that peace of mind. And obviously there are cons attached to it, but it's sustainable with the battery. Outside of that, yeah, probably sitting around the 5 or the 6, and the smaller systems as well, I think are good too. Yeah, I'm a huge fan. If you can afford to do this and you can include it in your plan, I think you should.
Yeah, when you're talking about electricity generation, you really want to start with what devices that you plan on using in SHTF, so you know how big to scale your system. I don't know about you, you can chime in there, but I think the big ones are, you want radios for communications. You want night vision. Hopefully you've got thermal, or some drones for security. That's really important. Batteries that you want to recharge, like that carbon monoxide detector, flashlights, headlamps, LED lights in your house so you can see where you're going at night, especially in the summer, small fans so you just blow some cool air in your face. Those things are critical. They don't use a ton of power. A really small system would be ideal for that sort of stuff.
So how big of a system would you need to do that?
Well, we talked about having an expert in solar on future episodes to help get into the details of how to size the system appropriate. But here's my rule of thumb when I think about solar. Most appliances in a house are going to be around 1500 watts. And the reason they're at 1500 watts is because they use a 15 or 20 amp breaker in your power box. So a 15 amp breaker is capable of handling 1875 watts. The rule of thumb there is the appliances should only use 80% of that available wattage. Because you can imagine if you had an appliance that used 1800 watts and you flipped on a light, then you trip the breaker. So appliances are generally limited to 80% of the 1875 watts, which is 1500 watts. So when I look for a portable solar system, I want something that can pull out at least 1500 watts because that's what most small appliances are going to use. So then the second question is, how many hours is that small portable solar system going to run for? I'll share what I have. I've got an EcoFlow River Pro 2, cost about $500. I just bought it recently. It's got an 1800 watt max output, and the battery is 768 watt hours of storage. All right, so what does that actually mean? It means my refrigerator can run for 4.5 hours. I could run a light bulb for 65 hours. I could charge my drone up 16 times. If you have a CPAP machine, you can run that for 12 hours straight. If you've got a couple of these portable solar stations with a few solar panels and a small inverter generator, even if you hit a string of cloudy days, you can still run the gas power generator, recharge the portable solar station. So that's exactly what we did in the RV. We would have an inverter generator. We'd run that for a couple hours, charge up our RV solar batteries, and then we'd run everything off the batteries.
So gas and diesel, if you're planning on bugging out, make sure you have enough gas or diesel to get you to your bug out location, plus an additional 20% for any detours that you might have to take. Beyond that, have enough gas to run an inverter generator for 2 to 3 hours a day for 90 days. If you want to work that out, the math behind that is for a Honda inverter generator, which uses about 0.12 gallons per hour at a 25% load, if you need 270 hours, you're going to need 33 gallons of gas for those 90 days. Here's how you store gas. You're going to take 12 5-gallon gas cans and you're going to buy fuel stabilizer. I use Stable, S-T-A-B-I-L. You're going to label each of those 5-gallon gas canisters by month, January through to December. Every month, you use one of those canisters that you filled up, you use on your car, you fill it up with 5 gallons, and then you go and you swap it out and you refill that and you add the fuel stabilizer. And that way, you're continuously cycling through your canisters of gas every month and refilling them so that you don't get in a situation like our friend did in the story that Jeffrey's told about not having any fuel on hand when SHTF.
So let me get this straight. You've got 12 5-gallon containers, January through December. It's September now. So I'm going to take September that's filled up from last year, dump that in my car, and then I'm going to go to the gas station, refill it back up, and then that's fresh. So I just have a year's worth of fresh fuel.
Yeah, and you put the stable with the new gas that you've just poured in your gas can. Gasoline will go stale over time, but you can put 12-month-old gas in your car, no problem.
All right, so you've got 60 gallons of gas, 33 for the generator. That leaves 27 for your bug-out trip and barter?
Any extras, yeah.
Okay, and also some homes, they use heating fuel, which is basically off-road diesel. Because your furnace still needs electricity to blow the air around, you're not going to be able to use that furnace or any furnace that requires electricity. So if you've got a tank worth of heating fuel in your house, what you might want to do is drain that tank and then use that fuel for either trucks if you have diesel, tractors if you have a tractor, or perhaps for barter. I'd imagine diesel fuel is going to be incredibly valuable in an SHTF situation.
Yeah, absolutely. What's your rating on gas and diesel?
I really like gas and diesel. For short term, it's a 7. It's super cheap. It's critical for vehicles, bugging out especially, generators as well. Great barter item. You're not going to use it for heating or cooking directly, but you could use it to run a generator, charge your electronic devices. So in that way, it is a support layer, but an absolutely critical support layer. Definitely a 7 for me. How about you?
Yeah, I love it. I think it's critical that you have a gas generator on hand. You know, I think, and that's the only thing that really limits you, similar to propane in a way, is just how much gasoline can you store safely. But yeah, it's critical to have one of these. I give it a 7 too.
Okay, we're going to do a bonus fuel type, which is wood. Before we get to that, let's take a quick look at the product spotlight.
This is the product spotlight. Wood is a fantastic fuel for a long-term grid down, but how do you chop and cut firewood without a chainsaw and log splitter? You guessed it, a felling axe and a two-man saw. Now getting your hands on a two-man saw can be tough, but we've got another option coming out of Japan, the Katanaboy Folding Saw by Silky. The Katanaboy is a two-handed, 20-inch folding saw that can easily compete with a chainsaw. It's shaped like a Japanese samurai sword, and its aggressive teeth make short work of logs. This is something you definitely want to have several of in a long-term grid-down situation. In fact, consider making it part of your group's minimum standard so every member has one. Now they aren't cheap, coming in at over $200, but they are built to last, and best of all, they can be sharpened, making this a sustainable option for an extended grid-down event. This isn't sponsored. We just think everyone needs to have a good axe, a good saw, and plenty of files on hand for SHTF.
Wood, all right, I think we've saved the best for last. This is one of my favorite fuel types. You can cook with it, you can heat with it, heck, you can even run some engines with it. But that's not why it's the best. It's the best because you can grow in your backyard.
Look, in many ways, wood is the least practical of any of the fuel sources in a normal environment. But in a grid-down environment, requires very little maintenance, and it really outshines everything else in its sustainability.
Heating with wood myself, I can absolutely say it is a pain. You've got to touch the item multiple times, from loading it from wherever you cut it onto your truck, to unloading it, to stacking it, to moving it in the house, to throwing it in the fireplace. Wood is a pain to use. Plus, it's dangerous. You're working with chainsaws. You're working with axes, hatchets, and you've got the creosote, which could lead to chimney fires. It is not an ideal fuel in and of itself. But the fact that you can grow it yourself or generate it yourself is amazing. So I think a combination of wood and solar, totally the way to go. You can heat and cook with wood. Solar really struggles with that. You can also run small devices on solar that you can't do with wood. So I think the combination of that is really what we're shooting for.
What about people who don't have a fireplace or trees in their backyard?
Yeah, when I built my house, I had two flues in the chimney. One for the main floor so I could do a wood cooktop stove. One in the basement so I could do a wood furnace. However, my parents' house, when they built it, they did not have a fireplace. So to answer your question, if you don't have a fireplace, if you want to put a wood stove in there, you can still do that. You can either go out through the wall and come up to the roof, or you can just go straight to the roof. They've got kits that allow you to convert your house over to a wood cooktop stove or a wood stove. Now, second part of your question, what if you don't have good firewood on your property? We didn't have good firewood here on my house. All we had was pines, and pines are terrible for burning. So what did we do? The first thing we did is we started planting black locust trees. They're growing very quickly. They're all around my property. That's what I'd recommend.
Why black locust over oak?
Okay, so in the US, the best trees for firewood are hardwoods. So that's black locust, oak, ash, hickory, mulberry, and beech. The problem with hardwoods is that they grow very slowly. That's kind of what makes them a good firewood, is that density of the tree. But of course, it takes a long time to build that density. Black locust, on the other hand, it grows very quickly relative to other hardwoods. So when you cut down black locust, something really cool happens is that it will send out runners that spur new shoots up to 30 feet away. They reproduce very easily. You don't have to plant them. It's got one of the highest BTU output of any common hardwoods in the US at 29.3 compared to oaks 26.4. Everyone loves heating with oaks. You're going to love heating with black locust even more. What else is very cool is it's got very little smoke, very little creosote buildup, and has phenomenal coaling. So if you're not familiar with coaling, it's after you burn a log, those coals that are left over, the bigger the coals are, the easier to start a new fire in the morning, and it keeps that wood stove hotter for longer.
How much wood do you think someone would use in a 3-month emergency?
It totally depends. I was trying to figure this out myself on how much wood we used this past winter. Okay, so here are the variables that you're going to consider. First off, is your wood seasoned? Seasoned wood is going to burn much better than unseasoned wood. And when I say seasoned wood, it's the moisture content. The drier the wood, the better it's going to burn, the less smoke it's going to produce. So you got wood seasoned, depends on what fireplace you have, how efficient. If it's an open fireplace, you're going to use a ton of wood. If it's an insert in your fireplace, it's going to be more efficient. If it's a wood stove, it's going to be more efficient. If it's a newer wood stove, it's going to be more efficient. There's all sorts of efficiency considerations. The type of wood you use, as I mentioned, the hardwoods have the highest BTU. That's going to put out the most heat for the longest. If you're heating with softwoods, it's just going to be very quick and going to burn right up, produce a lot of ash. That's not what you want. So if you've got a very inefficient setup, let's say you're burning outdoors on a grill or you have a fireplace, you're going to use several cords in maybe a month if it's the dead of winter. If you've got a very efficient setup, a cord could last you an entire month or longer. It really depends on if you're heating and cooking or just heating, all sorts of variables. But my recommendation is you want to have several cords of wood stored up, real good seasoned hardwoods.
What do you think of an outdoor wood boiler?
I looked at outdoor wood boilers. For one, they're really expensive. I was trying to price one out for my house. It was like $15,000 for a small one, and they go up to $25,000 for heating a large house. And that right off the bat was out of my price range. But then I realized that you also need electricity to run the outdoor boiler, because there's a fan that keeps the fire going. And then there's a fan inside that blows the hot air through your duct system. So if you don't have electricity, or if it's EMP, your outdoor boiler is not going to work. You'll have to have some sort of generator, or you'll have to have maybe some backup parts for the fans or the boards that fry. I wouldn't do it just because it's really not that EMP resilient.
Okay. So with all of that, how do you rate wood for a 3-month emergency?
Ooh, I think wood is crucial for an emergency. If you're already set up for wood, I would say it's like an 8 or 9. Just buy extra cords of wood or chop up extra cords of wood. have them on hand. It can literally be a lifesaver. If you don't have a wood setup right now, I don't think it makes sense to get into it for a 3-month emergency. Probably just lean into propane or one of those alternate fuels that we mentioned. How about you?
I'm exactly the same. I think critical, it's great to fall back on as well because it's so abundant. But if you don't have the wood stove, I wouldn't use it. You know, you have to be ready set up to use it if that's going to be your primary go-to.
Yeah, definitely for a longer emergency. Like if I'm shooting for a 1 year or longer grid down scenario, I'm going to design the retreat around wood because that's the sustainable source. Wood and solar are my go-to fuel sources for a long retreat. 3 months, you can kind of get away with a generator and propane, etc. Okay, we've rated each fuel type separately. Let's recap what we discovered. One, if it is an EMP, natural gas is pretty much out. You're out of luck there. Propane and wood is great as a go-to fuel for heating and cooking and heating your water. Keep an inverter generator on hand, preferably in a Faraday cage, and try to lean to those small solar systems. 1500 watts or larger is really going to help you keep those small devices powered up. So given all that, what is our mission for this week, JD?
Yeah, so for this episode, I'd like you to build a multi-layered approach to power generation. So think of it like this. You're going to need a gas-fueled generator, preferably an inverter one, that you can fire up and you can run all your major appliances off. You're going to have 12 gas cans labeled for each month and rotate and stabilize this fuel monthly. The second thing you need to think about is solar. Get your 1800-watt portable solar generator with at least a 200-watt panel. That is going to also help keep your appliances charged and your smaller items going. And then you're going to look at propane. So get a few 20-pound propane canisters and a small adapter that will allow you to move the propane from those larger canisters to a smaller 1-pound canister that you can use to cook and heat off of. And then finally, wood. If you have a fireplace or a wood stove, you're going to want at least 3 cords of wood. If you're able to get all 4 of these items and power sources lined up, you should feel pretty good about being able to keep your smaller items charged that will survive the EMP because you're going to keep them in a Faraday cage. And we'll talk about that in a different episode. And also to keep your family fed, be able to cook efficiently and quickly the food that you need in order to survive.
All right, a couple quick comments on the wood piece. Even if you don't have a fireplace or you're not set up for wood, it's probably still a good idea to have maybe 1/4 cord or 1/4 of wood on hand because you can still make a campfire. You can still cook things over a campfire. You can still have a burn barrel and heat yourself up like the hobos do. Burn some trash in your burn barrel. Wood's great for that. And the second thing I'd say is if you're going to get that gas generator, try to get one that has at least a dual fuel type, which would be gas and propane, and stock up on your propane canisters. If you have natural gas, you can get a natural gas. There's sometimes generators with 3, but definitely get gas and propane. And if it's a brand new generator, just use the propane. Don't use the gas because the gas is going to eat up all of the rubber and the interiors, gunk it up over time. The propane's not going to do that. So just use propane primarily and then have the gas as a backup in case you run into a big emergency. If you stayed with us throughout this monster episode, you'd probably like a jingle when our next episode becomes available. We publish a new episode every Monday morning. All of the major podcasting platforms, including Apple, Spotify, and Google, they pick up the show and they'll alert the show's followers on those specific platforms. If you'd like to join our Telegram channel, t.me/getreadypodcast, where you can join into our conversation, where we're constantly discussing products, we're talking about scenarios, we're answering your questions, and we're sharing great deals on prepper items. With that, Jeffries, we'll see you out.
Did you know you can remove pine sap from your handsaw by rubbing alcohol on the blade? Neither did I, but RB tells me it's a thing. Want to tell a friend about the podcast, but not sure where they should go? You can send them to getreadypodcast.info, and they'll see all the past episodes, including this one. This is Jeffries, signing off for the Get Ready Podcast. See you next week, unless of course China invades Taiwan, or Russia drops a czar bomb on Ukraine, in which case, I'll be in my bunker.